In this hour of the show, we'll be talking about the relationship between Britain and the United States and the leaders of the two countries, Tony Blair and George Bush. There would have been a time when the kind of alliance that has been forged between these two men would have seemed impossible. However, we know that Britain has been the most reliable backer of the United States and George Bush in its wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. Why is it that the British Prime Minister seemingly put his own political future in jeopardy to support a war, the Iraq War, that the British people opposed? Well, this morning on the program, we'll be talking with British journalist James Naughtie. He's the author of a new book, which is titled The Accidental American, Tony Blair and the Presidency. Public Affairs is the publisher of the book. It's out now in the bookstores. And it indeed explores this question of Mr. Blair and his involvement with the United States. And of course, questions, comments are certainly welcome. People can participate simply by calling us. The only thing we ask is that people are brief in their comments, and we ask that so that we can accommodate as many callers as possible and keep the program moving. But of course, anyone here is welcome to call. The number in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, which means that wherever you are listening, around Illinois or Indiana or throughout the United States on the Internet, the toll-free line is there for you. That's 800-222-9455. Let me tell you just a little bit more about our guest, James Naughtie. He's lead anchor of BBC Radio 4's Today Show. He is also former chief political correspondent of The Guardian in London. He's an award-winning broadcaster and writer and has contributed to many newspapers and magazines and indeed has written a lot about Tony Blair and had the opportunity to sit down and talk with him on a number of occasions. And we're also pleased to have him with us. Mr. Naughtie, thanks very much for talking.
Oh, thanks, David. It's very nice to be with you.
We certainly appreciate it. One of the things, certainly, we know we're looking at Tony Blair and the reaction of the British people to, particularly to the Iraq War. There was a time early on when it looked as if his political future and the future of his government was in question. Now, recently, he has said he intends to stand again, and if he and the party are successful, serve out another full term as prime minister. And of course, no one knows how that's going to play out. But given the fact that at one time people seemed to be talking about his imminent fall and that now he's talking about serving out a third term, that seems to me to be a fairly remarkable kind of turnaround.
Well, you're right. It is remarkable, David. And I think that, once again, people who underestimate Blair make a terrible mistake. The political landscape here is covered in the corpses of people who have underestimated his resilience. He is a remarkable character, as you say. I think that the idea that he might have fallen over Iraq was always one that was exciting, remarkable, dramatic, even to contemplate it, because here was a prime minister who'd been elected with a huge majority in 1997 and again with 2001, with almost untrammeled political power, great dominance over the political scene. But I think the idea that he might fall was always one that was, while possible, always unlikely. He had told his family in March 2003, when the vote came in the House of Commons here about the Iraq War, that he might have to go if most of his party voted against him, even if he technically won the vote with the support of the opposition Conservatives. I always think myself that that was unlikely. It was possible, and it was a very, very dramatic moment. I think the truth about Tony Blair is that he's been blessed with an opposition which is still divided, still in a state of trauma after the defeat in 1997, after 18 years in government under Mrs. Thatcher and John Major. And it still hasn't got itself together, frankly. So he's, partly by his own efforts, he's managed to command the middle ground of politics in this country to such a remarkable degree that the opposition still doesn't quite know what to do. And therefore, the chances are, given his strength in Parliament, that he'll go into the next election very much the favourite to be elected with a lower majority in Parliament, but nonetheless with one that will allow him to continue as Prime Minister.
Well, some people, I think, there have raised questions about the advisability of Mr. Blair's saying on the one hand that he intended to serve out a full term, but then he would resign. And everything that I read says that now people are saying, well, you know what that means is he's declared himself to be a lame duck, that even if he wins and again becomes Prime Minister, then the big topic of conversation will not be so much Mr. Blair, but will be who will succeed him.
Well, absolutely. It's a no-win situation. You know, a prime minister is in the position of, obviously, depending on the results of his party's fortunes in the election, the biggest party in the House of Commons, provides the prime minister through its leader. Now, for Blair, it's very difficult going into the third term. If he says, look, after 10 years, I will have done enough, and in the midst of the third term, I might want to step aside and make way for someone else. People say, well, why should we vote for a man who says he's not going to be there for the whole time? If he then says, well, I will serve the whole of the third term and then go just before the next election, people say, well, you know, can we believe this? Is this something which he will do? He'll have been there by 11 or 12 years by the end of a third term, and either way he's subject to criticism. It's very unusual for a prime minister to go into a third term election. Lady Thatcher did it, her third term. He's doing it, and really you can't win. You've got to say you'll see it through. And if you say you see it through, people say, oh, this man is terrible. He's going to go on and on. We're never going to see the end of him. But if he says, well, I'll decide halfway through the third term, they say, as we would say in this country, you're being asked to vote for a pig in a poke. You know, you're being asked to vote for a false prospectus because we don't know who will be the prime minister at the end of the term. So it's a very difficult situation. The point that you've got to remember, I think, is that Blair, although he's deeply damaged and stained, I think, politically, and that will last forever, from the Iraq experience, is still in charge in this country and is still likely to be in charge, I would guess, for some years yet.
Mm. When Bill Clinton was president, there was a lot written about how alike he and Mr. Blair were, and particularly in their political strategies of taking their parties, which had been perceived as having drifted perhaps a bit to the left, and drag them more toward the center, and about how that was a successful strategy for them. So there seemed to be this sort of natural affinity between the two men. Then if you however look at Mr. Bush and Mr. Blair, now there you don't see the same kind of matchup.
And that's right.
I think a lot of people say, given what they perceive to be the two men's personality, that the kind of bond that appears to have developed between the two of them is unlikely, to say the least.
Well, I think it's interesting you use the word personality there, because I think if you look at their political backgrounds, just in terms of the party, clearly Tony Blair's party, traditional socialist party in days gone by, went through an enormous ideological convulsion in the 80s and 90s, not least because of Blair's own efforts before and after he became leader, and is now what we would call in Europe a centre-left party, a mainstream sort of social democratic party, that kind of thing. George Bush, obviously coming from a Republican tradition, although his family clearly on the more liberal side of the party rather than the conservative side. But, you know, the truth of it is that they're coming together was a personal thing rather than an ideological thing. After Bill Clinton left office, and he and Blair had a very close relationship, they had their rows, but they were extremely close in many ways, politically and as friends, and Blair had learned a great deal from the Democrats in their 92 and 96 campaigns about how to do exactly what you've described. And after Clinton left and Gore lost in 2000, Blair was terrified, to be frank, I think, about what might follow. He didn't know George Bush at all. They'd never met. And when he came to Camp David in February 2001, just after Bush's inauguration, he was surprised and enormously relieved to discover that they actually got on very well. And the reason they got on well, above all, was I think that they had quite a lot in common, and this surprised them. They were both very informal in style. You know, Blair is the first prime minister who can wear jeans without looking stupid. He's a very informal, easygoing man. They both approach politics by instinct rather than ideology. They both like to make decisions that they feel are right, rather than after having had a seminar. And they can talk in straightforward ways. And I think they hit it off. And, you know, the other thing was that Blair was already becoming obsessed by Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan, long before 9/11. Very worried about it. Anxious about terrorism and rogue states coming together. He'd made speeches on that subject, one in Chicago, not far from where you sit now as I speak to you. In Illinois, he'd gone to Chicago, the first sitting prime minister, to make a speech there to the Economic Club in 1999 and talked about a doctrine of preemption in international affairs. He was concerned about this, talked to Bush about it at the first meeting. They were getting on well in the summer of 2001, and then suddenly 9/11, and it electrified the relationship. Blair, because he's got a great sense of the dramatic and the theatrical in politics, I don't say that pejoratively, it's simply a fact. He's got an ability to find the words. He's also a very emotional man, and he felt America's pain, I think, very strongly, really quite deeply and genuinely. And I think at that point, the relationship, it was almost as if it was a sort of pottery, a piece of pottery that had been put in a kiln, you know, and fired, and it solidified, and it got into a state where I think Blair felt that it couldn't be broken and shouldn't be broken. And then afterwards, when they had the long arguments about how you went about Iraq, the extent to which you went through the UN process, I think Blair underneath, although he was very conscious of the difficulties of the politics of it for him, always felt that he'd made a commitment which he shouldn't and couldn't break. And in the end, despite his unpopularity at home, which sort of went down as it went up. I mean, his popularity at home was in inverse proportion to his popularity in the United States. As it went down at home, it went up in Washington. He felt that he had to see it through, and he did. And he is deeply embarrassed by the failure to find weapons of mass destruction, deeply embarrassed and politically wounded by it. But he does not regret for one moment the decision of principle to go. And that is what makes Blair stand out to the fury of his opponents, many of them in his own party at home.
Yeah, just one to take that one step further. Going back to this idea that perhaps we might have of how different Blair and Bush are. If you look at what they've said about the idea of preemptive war, the war in Iraq, this idea that there is some sort of burden placed upon the shoulders of Western democratic nations like Britain and the United States. If you look at the kind of things that he said, they are very much like the kinds of things that President Bush has said. One can imagine President Bush saying the same thing in slightly less schooled sort of rhetoric, but essentially saying the same thing.
Oh, indeed. And when people put it, and I've put this to Tony Blair myself, that it's curious that he ends up in bed, as it were, as we would say in Britain, with neoconservatives of the Donald Rumsfeld, Paul Wolfowitz, Dick Cheney type, who, of course, start from a completely different point of view. And Blair says, well, I start from an internationalist point of view where I believe that the institutions like the UN and so on have to be built up to be stronger and stronger. But in the end, he said, if my analysis of what you do with Saddam Hussein is the same as Dick Cheney's or Paul Wolfowitz, starting from really a very different ideological starting point, then that doesn't bother me one bit. If we agree, it's important and we can see it through. And I think that was always Blair's view. Now, he wanted to bind the United States into the United Nations process. And he, I think, said to George Bush, well, he did say to George Bush, look, there are two things that I need from you if I'm going to go all the way with you to Baghdad. One is a commitment that the American administration will seek as much UN cover, support, consensus as is possible, an international coalition. And the second is that the Middle East peace process between the Israelis and the Palestinians will be revived, hence the roadmap. Now, what Blair's critics at home in his own party and those who've left his government over this issue would say is that he's lost out in both of those. They would say betrayed, that the Middle East peace process was never really revived in a serious way, and that after Resolution 1441 in the autumn of 2002 was passed, the administration wasn't interested in getting a specific resolution to say we authorize war if Saddam doesn't cooperate with the weapons inspectors, because the administration believed, perfectly rightly from its point of view, that wasn't necessary, that 1441 gave it the authority. Blair's party didn't believe that was authority, and therefore they believed when he went to war he didn't have full legal authority from the United Nations. And that really politically was the difficult point for Blair. If he'd had a specific UN resolution, as in 1991 in the first Gulf War, to say, we believe that Saddam has defaulted on all these things for 12 years, and it is right now, all the options have run out, to go for a military action, Blair's political position at home would have been much, much easier. He would have had reluctant, but I think majority support in the population. And at the moment, although he has got considerable support, I think many people feel that he, well, I wouldn't say sold his soul to George Bush, that he sold his support too cheaply. That's the view. And when people say to him, what did you get back for all this? It's quite a difficult question for Blair to answer. He can say, well, I got a policy that I believe in. But if they say, well, what was the quid pro quo? You know, what did Britain get out of this relationship, apart from being dragged along with Mr. Bush into this war? It's quite a tricky question for Blair to answer.
Our guest in this hour, Focus 580, James Naughtie. He's lead anchor of BBC Radio 4's Today Show. He's also former chief political correspondent of The Guardian in London and has a new book out that's titled The Accidental American, Tony Blair and the Presidency. It's published by Public Affairs, out now. Questions are welcome. We do have someone who has been patiently waiting. We'll get right to them. Others certainly welcome to call 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Caller here is in Indiana on our toll-free line right here. Hello.
Hello. I guess if I didn't know your history, I'd be asking a much more acerbic kind of questions. But my first reaction was, you remind me of McClain from Arizona, who criticizes Bush quite a lot, but is willing to get on the stump and, you know, be the political puppet without any problem whatsoever. I'm wondering, the quid pro quo thing is what I was thinking about, and you went into it, so I presume there was no money handed underneath the table to help failing industries or anything like that.
No.
And I guess my second question is Blair worth $30 million like Bush is? Third question would be, do you think things would change if the British actually engaged, the insurgents and things like that in a more willing way, where there'd be more deaths and the press would be somewhat more critical?
Well, I think that's just to take your
one thing.
Oh, sure.
Then I'll get off.
No.
The fourth thing is that it almost is, you know, you talked about it's strange that they've all now strange people in the same bed, neoconservatives and a party in Britain that's basically a little bit left to center.
Yes.
It's somewhere in there that the means justify the ends or the ends justify the means is popping up in my mind. And if you could tweeze those out a little bit, it would be interesting.
Well, it's an interesting set of questions. The $30 million, I think Tony Blair might wish he was worth $30 million. He isn't. I can assure you of that. And no money under the table. No, in Blair's mind, it was a question of principle. It's what he would call conviction politics. As far as Britain's engagement in Iraq is concerned and the public reaction, I mean, you're clearly right that if British casualties were much higher, it would be even more difficult for Blair. I think he would, were he here, react quite strongly to the suggestion that British troops aren't engaged in a dramatic way. I mean, obviously, numbers are far fewer. I mean, the whole British army is only 100,000 people, which is less than half the number of American soldiers who are in Iraq. I mean, we're talking here about a superpower and a second league player, so the level of involvement simply can't be as great, and that's fairly obvious. But, you know, we had an appalling episode last week in which a British subject, a businessman, was beheaded, and the film shown on the internet with all the grotesque paraphernalia that you've had for American citizens in Iraq. So the agony with them demanding concessions from Blair and him having to say, well, governments can't give concessions to terrorists because if we do next week, there'll be more kidnappings. Now, that was an extraordinarily traumatic episode of the sort that you had in your own country with Nick Berg and others, and rather like the dreadful business of Daniel Pearl in the Indian subcontinent. So there has been agony, there has been trauma, there haven't been 1,000 deaths because the scale of involvement is not so great. As far as Blair and the nature of his commitment and his belief in the neocons, I think from Blair's point of view, it is a question of the means being justified because he believes, now the evidence at the moment is strongly against him, but he's always believed, and I've talked to him about this on several occasions, that there was potentially a virtuous cycle in the Middle East. If Iraq could be reborn as a semi-democratic country, not some kind of perfect democracy, but something of the sort that we begin to see developing in Afghanistan, if the reformers in Iran could be encouraged by that and build there a strong country, then with all the uncertainty about the future of Saudi Arabia, you might have two states there who could begin to spread the idea that democratic reform in the Arab world, slow as it's bound to be, given all the history and all the culture, could begin to start. In Syria, for example, things might open up. In Egypt, you know, a 30-year-old state of emergency might be lifted. A successor to Mubarak might spring from some kind of democratic consensus, that in the Gulf states you might begin to get an opening up. Now, this is Blair's argument, that at some point in the Middle East you've got to start this process. It's long, it's generational, but it might come. And if you don't start, in the meantime, you might get, and he used the word Armageddon, I mean, you might get nuclear material leaking around into the hands of terrorist groups, and who knows what might happen. The huge argument that we're having at home, as you're having in the States, and I've spent a lot of time in the States in the last 6 months, largely to do with the election, is that there are many people who believe that his vision of what might happen in the Middle East is hopelessly optimistic, that instead of his idea of democratic beginnings and a new awakening, and, you know, remember, let freedom reign, George Bush wrote on that bit of paper at the summit in Istanbul when he heard of what had happened in Iraq. I think that many people feel that what you're going to get in the interim is something rather more like chaos, and out of that chaos you might get more radical Islam, more difficulties between the Palestinians and the Israelis, more problems in the Indian subcontinent with nuclear material going around, and in fact the idea that the removal of Saddam in the way that it happened was going to improve things is something in the short term which isn't going to happen. Now that would be the critic's argument, and I think, I mean, I won't give you my view, but I think in Blair's political world here, the jury, in terms of his electorate, is still out on that. I mean, I think he'll be re-elected for other reasons. Iraq won't be the main issue. But I think on Iraq, Blair is not thought to have made the case that this is clearly progress. But he believes, in the long run, that he will be vindicated and that the invasion will be shown to have been the right thing to do. I mean, he believes it. There's no question about that. His critics have to accept that he has behaved with good faith in that sense all along.
All right, let's go to another caller here. Champagne, line one. Hello.
Yes, well, maybe you did answer my question, but I'll ask it again and you can say whether you answered
it.
I guess I'm interested in what the British and Europeans see, other than Tony Blair, as a solution to, you know, the problems in the Middle East and especially the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. Mm. And how does that correspond or go along with the problems in Egypt or Iraq or other or Saudi Arabia in terms of democracy and the fact that the people resent that they aren't having democracies and it seems that their authoritarian governments are supported by the West. And then, you know, maybe you can bring in the French and the Germans or the Labour and the Conservatives.
Well, yes. I mean, this is very interesting territory, isn't it? I think you probably realize that in Europe the whole attitude to the Israeli-Palestinian crisis, which has been with us for as long as any of us can remember, is really different. I remember a former British ambassador in the United States saying to me, you know, people talk about the special relationship between Britain and America. I always say to the diplomats in the embassy that they must never use this phrase, partly because it sounds rather complacent and it induces a sense of complacency in the way they do business, as if they're entitled to special access and so on. But he said there's another reason, actually a rather more profound reason, that the only special relationship that the United States has with a country abroad is with Israel, because in the end, Israel is the only country which can affect profoundly domestic American politics. And I think that's true, and it's not true in Europe. Now, we don't want to get into all the history of that conflict, but Blair is absolutely passionate about trying to get a move on. I think he's extremely disillusioned with the Palestinian Authority and with Arafat in particular. He's also extremely skeptical about Mr. Sharon and his policy of disengagement, and he's desperate to get it back on track. And I know, in fact, that he believes that he has a pledge from President Bush that if he is re-elected, and obviously we don't know what's going to happen in 2.5 weeks' time, but that there will be a push to try to revive things, and I dare say a Kerry administration would try to do the same. But there is a passion in Europe for doing something about this. The French, well, I know the French aren't especially popular in the United States at the moment, and there's a great deal of criticism in Britain as well, I think, about French foreign policy in the Middle East, which has been pretty self-interested, not for the first time in history, over the years and the deals with Saddam and so on. But Europe as a whole, I think, is very committed to trying to get the Israeli-Palestinian thing going again. And I think everybody feels, including Blair, and I know he feels this very strongly, that if that problem is not tackled directly, then all sorts of other things proliferate. The radicalization of Palestinian youth continues, the suicide bombings continues, the ability of radical Islamists to use this as a running sore to develop feelings against the West continues. And it's got to be confronted directly. And in the end, the only person who can confront it directly, because he's the only person with the authority to do so and the pull on Israel, is the President of the United States, whoever that president is. And in the end, I know that Blair feels, as the rest of Europe feels, that that issue has to be addressed in a practical way. Pressure has to be put on both sides. Otherwise, a Palestinian leadership will not emerge that can do a deal with Israel. Now, the President, President Bush, has said on several occasions he wants a two-state solution. Kerry wants the same. The question is, will either of them try to deliver it after November?
And do you think that the Europeans, somewhere along the line, there's a more realistic assessment of what is going on, for example, in Iraq? And, you know, do you think that any real changes can be implemented in the Middle East in its overall structure by the West countries? And,
and even
if there were, how that would be interpreted in the discourse on the ground there? I mean, it doesn't seem like...
Well, the argument, of course, is whether it can be imposed or whether it has to be assisted. And this is one of the arguments about the war, isn't it? That there are those who argue that the removal of Saddam, welcome as it obviously was to most Iraqis, was something which sets that process back. Others, including Blair, argue that it lanced a boil, you know, that this was a break. And after a period of flux, of great difficulty, of inevitable violence, good things will emerge. Now, that is his contention. There are others who know the Middle East well who think that it's really a piece of self-delusion, because, in fact, the destruction laid waste a country in a way which will take a very long time to rebuild. I mean, I was in Iraq just after the invasion, and I remember all the Iraqis saying to all of us Western correspondents, look, we're extremely happy that Saddam is gone. We're grateful in that sense for the invasion. What we want to happen now is for the occupying force to go as quickly as possible. But of course, the state of Iraq was such that that became impossible. Insurgents came in. And it's a terrible bind. We're all going to be there for years. It's inevitable. To which the old Middle East hands in London say to Blair, we told you so. And he says, well, someday you'll thank me for doing it. And I certainly wouldn't like to make a judgment about who's going to be right in 10 or 20 years, but I'm afraid we won't know until after that period and after a lot more blood has been shed. I think that's beyond argument, beyond dispute. It's clearly a fact.
We have some other callers here. We'll get on to them in just a moment. Our guest is James Naughtie. He's the lead anchor of BBC Radio 4's Today show, also as former chief political correspondent of The Guardian in London, and is author of the new book, The Accidental American, Tony Blair and the Presidency. 333-9455, here for Champaign-Urbana, toll-free, 800-222-9455. On again to another caller. This is Champaign County and Line 2. Hello.
Hi. I think there is a special relationship, and Blair is accepting of it, and that's being a junior partner in Empire, and I don't know that you really want to talk about that since you sort of... So I think that everything is multi-determined, and I think we can also talk about Blair's psychology somewhat.
Yes.
And I'm just wondering, I happened to watch Jeremy Paxman ask Blair if he prayed with Bush.
Yes.
And it caused a big row over there, I understand, and... obviously, people have to be, politicians over there have to be used to more provocative questions than they are here.
That's true.
With this Hamilton guy grilling him at the party conference, too. That was amusing. Wish we had it here. But what I'm getting at is there seems to be... I don't want to blame all irrationalism on Catholicism or Christianity or something like that, but it seems to me that you can't talk about him without talking about faith.
This is a very interesting question. This
guided, but yeah, go ahead, please.
It's a very interesting question that you put your finger on. As you say, one of my colleagues at the BBC, Jeremy Paxman, asked him really at the height of the anxiety about Iraq as we were leading to war, whether he prayed with George Bush, and Blair almost fell off his seat with surprise. And I think one of the reasons was, and I think this is quite an important point, that Blair is a devout man in private, but very much in the tradition of British politics, where religion isn't worn on the sleeve in public life, and people are very suspicious of someone who uses religiosity as a kind of political weapon. He's willing to talk about it if asked, and that makes him stand out. But Blair's Christianity is of an exceedingly liberal sort, and he is deeply embarrassed when it is suggested that simply because he goes to church every Sunday, he's a sort of follower of Jerry Falwell or something. I mean, he finds right-wing fundamentalism, as he would describe it himself, in the United States, something which is deeply unappealing to him. I mean, if you look at all the great social questions which the fundamentalist right in the United States, the religious right, take as absolutely baseline issues, on whether it's on homosexuality or an abortion. I mean, Blair is very much on the liberal side of that argument. I mean, his view about abortion is that their family would not practice it, but he would never interfere with anyone's right to make a different decision. And although he's not formally a Catholic, his wife and children are, and he attends a Catholic church every week, and he, I think, has had some difficult conversations with people in the Church of England and the Catholic Church about that view. But he does not subscribe to any of the conservative social principles which would be associated with the religious right in the United States. So that's why he was really quite embarrassed when I said, do you pray with George Bush now? I mean, if he was sitting at a table with George Bush and the president said, let's bow our heads for a moment's silence before we have it, of course Blair would, as a matter of politeness, apart from anything else, would feel very comfortable with that. But, I mean, the notion of Tony Blair going to a prayer breakfast is just outlandish. I cannot tell you. I mean, he would run a mile. So
I'm not sure. I guess you have a better vantage. But what I was getting at was he seems to transpose some kind of faith into his politics in a more subtle way. In that he's, evidence be damned. I mean, they said last night on Newsnight, there has been no analysis of Alistair Campbell's role, really. There has been no, and he keeps saying there are
four reports. We're getting into, you're a very well-informed caller. Alistair Campbell, just so that listeners will know, thank goodness people in Illinois and Indiana have not had to deal with Alistair Campbell, who is a sort of Karl Rove for Tony Blair, only bigger and rougher. Now gone. You're right, though. I mean, to get to you, the essence of your point, that leaving aside the formalities of religious practice, there is a kind of attitude to belief which characterizes Blair's politics. He landed in some ways, you know, at the feet of Margaret Thatcher. He grew up as a young backbencher in Parliament in the sort of force field of her ideological challenge. And he concluded, I think, although that he had enormous differences with her practice of politics and her beliefs, that the only way you could do it if you got into office was by this assertion of conviction and the determination to follow through on a belief if it became overwhelming. And I think that, to his critics, has become a weakness. To him, it's a strength because he believes that it preserves his integrity. I think on Iraq, it seems to me that the critics have a point when they say that he became so obsessed with the idea of preserving the transatlantic relationship. He says because he wanted to avoid America going in a more unilateralist way, cutting itself off further from allies, that it was vital to be inside, arguing the case privately with the president and with the State Department. But his critics say that in that effort, well-intentioned though it might have been, he sacrificed some of his own judgment, and he became caught up in a kind of crusade, in a sense, in which he didn't believe. And I know, for example, that he's been acutely embarrassed, and I think personally a little humiliated by the goings-on in Guantanamo Bay and Abu Ghraib prison and so, but Guantanamo Bay particularly, where some British citizens were held for 2 years without trial and without seeing a lawyer. And when they were finally released, they came home and the Home Secretary at home, the equivalent of your Attorney General, had to say, well, these people are free to go because we haven't any evidence to suggest that they're a threat to the security of the state, to which the obvious question was, well, why have you been standing by while they've been incarcerated for 2 years without being able to speak to a lawyer, which is something that any citizen in the United States or in Britain would be entitled to regard as an appalling infringement of their civil rights. So that's been a very difficult area for Blair, and I think he's had a certain dark night of the soul on that, but I think he got himself into a position where he was so far in that he couldn't get out.
I want to again thank the caller. We're moving into our last 15 minutes here, and I want to invite some others. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455, as we continue to talk with James Naughtie from the BBC. Something that you certainly have touched on a little bit, and I wondered if perhaps you could talk a little bit more about, is how it is the people within the Blair government thought about his support of the United States in the war on terror, and very specifically about Iraq. Certainly here in the United States, we know that within the administration there were differences of opinion, particularly between the Departments of State and Defense, although mostly that happened behind closed doors.
Yes.
In Britain, the politics are a little bit more bare knuckle, and there are people who are, you know, in the Blair cabinet would be more willing to stand up in out in the street and say things that here they wouldn't say.
It's an interesting point, David. You're right up to a point that certainly with a parliamentary system where ministers, after all, have to appear in the rough and tumble of parliamentary debate. As a matter of course, they're members of parliament and that's what they have to do. There is perhaps a wee bit more openness, but at the same time, there are the same subterranean strains in a government as you have in Washington. And if you look at the situation in Blair's government, where his closest ally and also rival, Gordon Brown, Chancellor of the Exchequer, Finance Minister, who is the twin pillar of the government, really, and a very, very strong figure, has uttered not a single word on Iraq which is supportive beyond the absolute bare minimum. I mean, if he comes on my program and people like me ask him, do you support the Prime Minister in Iraq? He will say, of course I do. Will you pay the bills for the soldiers were there? Yes, of course we will. We'll see it through. But has he taken the opportunity to go and, you know, he speaks around the country the whole time and make a speech on it off his own bat, willingly? The answer is no. Now that sends a signal out. There's a great, great deal of unease inside the government. I mean, it's an open secret that Jack Straw, the Foreign Secretary, equivalent of the Secretary of State, who battled mightily for a second UN resolution and has supported the Prime Minister throughout, is now saying publicly and semi-publicly how much he disagrees with what we might call the Cheney-Rumsfeld-Wolfowitz line on the Middle East. And he and Colin Powell were very close through the whole period. And he and Colin Powell saw themselves, I think, as allies against what you might call the hard-line view inside the administration. And I think both he and Powell, and certainly Tony Blair, believe, although Blair won't say it publicly at the moment, that what happened in Iraq after the invasion, if you like, the takeover by the Pentagon of post-invasion policy away from the State Department, the de-Ba'athification and so on, was an absolute catastrophe. I mean, it's quite open in the British government that they believe that things were dreadfully handled in Iraq after the invasion. Leave aside the question of the principle of the invasion itself. So I think there's a big gap there. And we do see gaps opening up between ministers. But I mean, you say it's bare knuckle. Well, it is, but, you know, there are an awful lot of nods and winks. It's not that different from Washington, to be honest.
Mm-hmm. We have some time here for other callers. We do have someone here standing by. Callers will really help us by being brief, however, just because we are coming down to the end of our time. But we'll go to Crystal Lake here, line number four. Hello. Yes.
Is right. Blair did have a link. I knew there was a Al-Qaeda danger to the United States. In fact, England and 10 other nations warned President Bush of the impending 9/11 attack, but Bush paid no attention, or neither did the White House. And Bush knew beforehand there was going to be a pending attack because 11 nations warned him, including Tony Blair's nation. And also, even the New York Post says that Bush knew beforehand of the impending attack. Richard Clark warned the White House of the impending attack 2 weeks before, on August 6th, of the 9/11 impending attack. But then somehow, and even though the terrorists were in Afghanistan or bin Laden, apparently, Bush didn't follow up on bin Laden at all, like Senator Kerry said last night.
Well,
and both Bush and Blair lied on the white paper starting a war in Iraq.
Well, I think the view you put there, which obviously is a view closer to Senator Kerry than Mr. Bush, I watched the debate last night as I watched all the others, that is very much the view of a lot of people around Blair. Blair himself, you know, I've talked to him a lot about this over the years, about his attitude to the president, and he, obviously he has to be slightly diplomatic, but there is an essential respect there, which doesn't extend to every aspect of Bush's policy, and I'm sure he's extremely critical in private of some of it, but he's very committed to Bush as someone that you can do business with, because he's straight. I mean, that in the end is what Blair says to skeptical colleagues who say, you know, how do you get along with this guy? Because, you know, Bush's standing in Europe is not that high for all sorts of reasons, not just because of Iraq. And Blair is a very stalwart friend to George Bush. Having said that, I should say something else. You know, whatever happens a fortnight on 2 weeks, I should say, on Tuesday, I mean, if John Kerry were to be elected, and we know the polls are neck and neck at the moment, no doubt there would be a slight froideur for a week or two, but I can assure you that Mr. Blair would be romping on the beach in Nantucket, you know, by Christmas. And Kerry, obviously, if he came in, would have to make alliances as best he could in Europe, and Blair would be there, and there might be a little bit of bad feeling about his support for Bush, but I think it would be over pretty quickly. And if you can make the move from Clinton to Bush, from Bush to Kerry, it doesn't seem to me to be impossible.
Hmm. In just recently, Mr. Blair, in talking about his intentions to stand again and his hope to again have another term as Prime Minister, he laid out his agenda, and he did get to discussing some domestic issues, and I would imagine that he might like to be able to talk about something other than Iraq.
I can assure you it wouldn't
so dominate things. Well, and here, and, you know, maybe some people here are surprised by just how much Iraq has dominated our presidential election here.
Well, looking at it from the outside, and I was at both conventions, and you know, spent quite a bit of the summer in the States, and I'm glad to say coming back at the end of next week for the denouement. The interesting distinction, you know, David, between the arguments is that the argument that Blair made to a skeptical public and a skeptical press about Iraq was very much based on the presence and the current threat from weapons of mass destruction. And his real problem is that he never made the case for regime change, pure and simple, in the way that was established under the Clinton administration and carried on through the Bush administration, that, you know, you went for Saddam. And the result is that the discovery that weapons of mass destruction are not there and probably weren't there in any form, any way that could threaten us in any immediate way, despite what he might have wanted to do in the future, is intensely politically embarrassing and damaging to Blair, because it knocks away the one pillar, really, that was holding his policy. I mean, he didn't say, I want to get rid of Saddam because he's a bad man, and I would justify the invasion on that basis. He more or less said, I couldn't justify it on that basis, but I justify it on the basis that, you know, he is doing things there with nuclear and biological chemical material, which before long will threaten us all. And the trouble is, the Iraq Survey Group last week, all the efforts of everybody to go in there hasn't turned up one little missile or one little bit of material that could do any of these things in the foreseeable future. And that is why it's so difficult for Blair. It's a different argument. You know, as the caller made the point earlier, I mean, British troops have not been dying in anything like the numbers, even proportionately, as American troops have suffered, for obvious reasons, because of the numbers you've got there and the burden you've taken on and the way you've done it. But the arguments as to why we did it and why we support the war have been really challenged by the various reports that have suggested the nature of the regime. It's, you know, it's degradation, its inability to do the things it was trying to boast that it could do, has really given Blair a very, very difficult case to make. And that's why it's such a damaging issue for him. And as you rightly say, David, as we go to an election, which I think will probably come in about 6 months, the Prime Minister, of course, has the ultimate timing of that election in his gift. He's going to try to get back onto health and schools and roads and railways and the state of the economy, in which he thinks he's got a much better case to make to the British people.
For a long time, at least according to what I read, the man who would be considered to be the Mr. Blair's right-hand man and a leading contender to succeed him, Gordon Brown, the Chancellor of the Exchequer. Just recently, however, Mr. Blair made some changes and handed the responsibility of policy formation and leading the party's effort in the new election. He has given this to someone else, Alan Milburn.
I wouldn't blame your listeners for not having heard of Alan Milburn.
Well, unless you actually pay attention to British politics, I'm sure you would not, or perhaps listen a lot to BBC.
I wouldn't worry too much about it, to be honest. Anyway. I think it's a very important signal. I think that I, in a previous incarnation, wrote a book about the Blair-Brown relationship about 3 or 4 years ago, and it's the dominating influence in this government. These were two men who grew up together in the Labour Party, who changed the Labour Party together, who couldn't both become leaders. That old adage, there's no friendship at the top, but were intensely close, were rivals and friends, were entangled in what you could call a political marriage, a very difficult thing to get out of, a very difficult thing to handle, in which all kinds of complicated emotions were let loose. And this rivalry, as well as their intense closeness over 7 or 8 years in power, has become, I think, a very painful thing for them, just as it has been the main pillar of their government's survival. And Brown expected, I think after a couple of terms of government, assuming they won them and they've had these huge majorities, that Blair at some point would step aside and allow his old friend to take on the mantle of power as an extremely powerful Chancellor of the Exchequer who essentially runs domestic policy. Blair has said he doesn't really think it's time for him to go at all, and he's going to carry on. And he brought Milburn in as a kind of modernising influence, because he and Brown don't agree on the way the welfare state, the social services, the way that government handles health and education and so on, should be handled. And I think what Blair was saying to Brown was, if you think that you're going to take over as Prime Minister and begin to unravel some of my market reforms in the welfare state, you've got another thing coming. In other words, I think that in the last 6 months there's been an ideological difference emerging between them, which is potentially quite difficult. I mean, the place I want to be, David, as a reporter, is in the Prime Minister's study the morning after the next general election, probably in early May next year, when he decides what he says to Gordon Brown. The jobs in the Cabinet, of course, are in the Prime Minister's gift. Does he say, I want you to carry on as Chancellor, you've been very successful, we've got low inflation, high growth, unemployment is down, all the rest of it, you've been a very successful Chancellor, carry on? Or does he say, no, I want a change there, and I want you to be Foreign Secretary? Because if he said that, I think Brown would say goodbye, walk out of the government, and I think you would then have an extremely unstable Labour Party, potential leadership crisis against Blair, potential change of Prime Ministers, all sorts of things could happen. It's a relationship that is intensely close, and for that very reason, intensely unstable. It's a paradox, but that's the way it is.
If Mr. Blair is successful and serves out another full term, he would be Prime Minister until something like 2009, I think.
Yeah, that's right. Mm.
And then if he retired at that point, served out that full term, he would only be, I believe, 56.
Yeah,
and there's a lot of speculation about what would be next for him.
It's a very interesting question. You know, I remember talking to him once about this, and he was very interested in what Bill Clinton would do, because Clinton obviously knew that he would have to leave office whatever happened in 2000. I mean, assuming other things hadn't happened and he was removed forcibly in between. But anyway, he would be gone by 2000. And Clinton was, 54, I think, at that point. Now, Blair was always fascinated. You know, what do you do when you're a 54-year-old man? I mean, if you're George Bush Sr., you have a splendid retirement and do all these things. If you're Jimmy Carter, the same. Ronald Reagan, clearly, is slipping into old age. It's very different if you're a 54-year-old man, vigorous. Well, we know that Bill Clinton's made a huge amount of money and is going around the world talking about everything under the sun. Blair, I think, incidentally, would quite like to make a lot of money. I mean, I don't say that as a It's not meant as a cheap shot. I mean, I think he's unembarrassed by that in a way that a lot of his predecessors, the leader of the Labour Party, would have been embarrassed. I don't know the answer to your question. I think that his problem is that it always been thought he might go for some big international job. I think the war in Iraq has been such a divisive issue in Europe, in the United Nations, around the world, that I think it rules him out of any of the kind of big jobs that he might have wanted to go for. I mean, I wouldn't rule out Blair popping up as the head of some big corporation. I mean, I know it sounds bizarre, but it's not out of the question. He's certainly not going to retire to some country vicarage and just write his memoirs. I mean, he'll write his memoirs, but I think he'll do other things beside. He had, as most of you, or some of your listeners anyway, will know, a heart procedure, not on the Clinton scale, I have to say, or anything like it, but a couple of weeks ago, an irregular heartbeat which required treatment. But I have to say, I saw him for a conversation about 2 weeks ago, and he seems to me as fit as a flea. I mean, he plays a very mean game of tennis, people say, still, and he works out every day, and he actually looks, despite the scars of war, which are visible, and the aging that happens to you in office, he looks younger than his 51 years.
You know, I think one of the things that please people about perhaps about President Carter and what he's done in his retirement is that he's continued to be very, very engaged and, in a sense, set up his own center for it to deal with international affairs. And I think a lot of people really respect that and applaud that. Could you imagine Mr. Blair doing something like that?
Yes, I could, actually. I could. Although I think that, you know, he's probably got some very active job in the meantime in him. But I could see something like that in the long term. His commitment to Africa, which is something he shares with Clinton, and you know that Bill Clinton talks a great deal about one of the greatest regrets, perhaps the greatest regret of his time in office, leaving all the Lewinsky business out of it, was the failure to do anything about Rwanda until it was too late. And I think that Blair feels an enormous sense of obligation to the African crisis, whether we're talking about debt or AIDS or political corruption or the wars that scar the continent. And a kind of commitment. He was in Ethiopia the other day trying to get this commission for Africa off the ground. Now, many people say it's a hopelessly optimistic, and you're dealing with a mountain that will never be moved of problems. But I think that is something where Blair has got a long-term commitment. It's something he shares with Brown, who's passionate about removing the debt from the shoulders of the developing countries. And that is something, if you're looking for an idea of a kind of a Carter-like reincarnation of internationalism, I think that's where, in Blair's case, it might come.
Well, there we must leave it because we're at the end of our time. Mr. Nakhti, thank you very, very much for talking with us today.
Well, it's been a great pleasure. It's very, very nice to talk to Illinois and Indiana, and hope you all have a very good time over the next 2.5 weeks.
We'll
be watching closely.
It won't be dull, we'll tell you that
It certainly won't be dull. And if, well, I think if Mr. Obama becomes Senator Obama, that'll be an interesting little thing. And I guess that's going to happen, is it?
It seems quite likely.
Okay.
Thank you.
It's been a great pleasure to be with you. Thank you very much.
Our guest, James Nakhti, he's the lead anchor of BBC Radio 4's Today Show. He's also former chief political correspondent of The Guardian in London. If you'd like to read his book on Tony Blair, it's titled The Accidental American, Tony Blair and the Presidency, and it's published by Public Affairs.